Well, the last time we chatted, it was on the occasion of reckless eyeballing, and I enjoyed that conversation. I guess that was a couple of years ago, right?
Right.
Tell me about some of your activities over the past
1986. That's when it was published.
Well, tell me about some of the activities over the past 2 years.
Well, let's see. Been teaching and writing.
Are you teaching at Berkeley?
Yeah, I'm still at Berkeley. This is my 20th year.
And tenured.
I know, finally, I'm tenured, part-time. It's unprecedented because they never given tenure to part-time instructors before. Just got back from Europe. Got it from Paris a couple days ago, here Tuesday, and did a tour of Switzerland and Germany. Same thing, I've also been traveling to Martinique off and on. I was there last year.
Why Martinique?
Well, they invited me to... some of the books are popular there, and I've been going, they've been inviting me to the university down there. And this is my second trip within about 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you saw the Times yesterday. I was looking around through the mess and debris in a hotel room through the clippings and everything. I've been cutting out for the last 2 weeks on my trips. But Sting announced that he's doing a second album. I think when I talked to you last, the first album was being produced.
Conjure.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're going to do Conjure 2.
A second version of that.
No, well, it's entirely new stuff. Uh-huh. What he's done is, American Clave had released the first album, and now he has a new outfit called Pangea, right? Record company, named after the original Continental, before Continental Drift. And that's one of the first albums he's re-released. It's in stores now. And we just completed a new album with Bobby Womack and some other people on it.
And doing instrumentals.
Yeah, poetry and songs.
Uh-huh. Well, the original Conjure was a great album. They sent me a copy of it, and what I did at the time, I used excerpts from it to go with the interview.
Great.
Worked out very nicely.
Excellent. Well, I think I should have brought a tape for you. I have the tape of the new album. I can get it sent to you.
Yeah, if they could send me a cassette tape, I'll do the same thing.
I could also send you a cassette, And what else? Still working with my foundation, the Fort Columbus Foundation, although there's new leadership.
Oh, wait, no, wait.
We had a foundation that promoted multicultural literature. One of the programs, very successful. We had the program American Book Awards at the ABA a few months ago, American Bookseller Association in Los Angeles. And we had Steve Allen and Jay Meadows. So that's an institution now. And we have new leadership. We have an Italian-American who runs it now. And we've been trying to make ties to what the newspapers they call white ethnics. So we have Italian Americans and more Irish Americans, Jewish Americans in the organization. So now it's everybody, the Rainbow Coalition, which we were doing, in the 70s. So I've been working with that in my press and doing more documentaries, television documentaries. Just produced a documentary that's going to be played in Europe. I just left it there, involving Al Young, the novelist. And talking about political issues and literary issues. So I'm going to do more television. And I'm writing plays, still doing plays. And Ed Bullins, I'm very fortunate that New York lost Ed Bullins, who wrote all these, who was here in the 60s and 70s. He's organized a theater on the West Coast, and he's directing my play, which is opening at the Black Repertory Theater in Berkeley July 15th and 16th, as well as this play and another one.
It sounds like life is not boring.
Not at all. I think, we keep busy, and we don't have the distractions in a town like Oakland as you do here. It's just so much stimulus here. Just so many things to do.
Well, you do have some distractions because in the lead essay in your book, you write about being very concerned about the crack.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm getting part of that piece was originally published in the San Francisco Examiner. I was writer-in-residence. They have a writer-in-residence program at the Examiner in San Francisco, and it caused an uproar. I mean, there's still repercussions. I think downtown is outraged, I heard. If you're furious with me, the developers and the politicians, because I'm, as the city manager told me when he called me up and scolded me, I'm giving Oakland a bad name.
For discussing a real problem?
Right.
Here in New York, in Queens, where it's really bad, these gangs are going around with submachine guns.
Well, that's what's happening.
Like the days in Chicago.
Well, I hear submachine gun fire outside of my house, outside of my window. And when this article came out, I think there was an attempted reprisal, and the police came and said that my kid would have to sleep in a kitchen every 1st and 15th of the month.
Why?
And, it was an attempted. I was out one Friday night at 8:30. What they do is they break down your windows and things, and it was attempted. After this article appeared, it was a break-in, you know, sort of attempted break-in while my kid and wife were sitting in the living room. And we called the police, of course, and they said that, you know, that they might come back later on that night and shoot the windows out. So it's pretty bad. And what's happening is that the police chief of Oakland is very frank about and very, you know, about the situation. But some of the other people downtown want to shush this thing up because they want investors to come in Oakland. And so they're really, that's happening all over the country. People, the downtown establishment, very concerned about development and growth. And are kind of like divorcing themselves from the problems of the neighborhood.
But they can't run away from a major social problem like that.
Well, you know, it just seems to be a pattern where we, you know, in this country, we attempt to run away from problems until they become a crisis, until a drought happens. And well, I mean, it just seems to be a pattern. Right now, I've become very interested in the channels of distribution for drugs, and I see that all I see is like... the black crack operators and police. I was on a show in San Francisco, and the police and the blacks were at opposite at each other's throats. I said, well, look, the police and the community are victims. You know what I mean? They always escape goats, and, you know, when you want to sensationalize something, you put them out there. But nobody goes into, like, the business community, which must bear responsibility, the bankers who launder the money. You know, we had a major brokerage firm in New York here pled guilty a few weeks ago to laundering money, underworld money. You have the gun shops in Los Angeles that sells these sophisticated weapons to kids without any questions. You have realtors. You know, I think the guys putting pressure on our area in Oakland got busted, and it was revealed that he had a $350,000 house. You know, he's 22 years old. I mean, somebody didn't ask the guy the right questions and had all this money in a bank, and according to what I've read, I may be wrong, you're supposed to report every deposit over $10,000, right? This guy had all this money. I mean, it's just like a lot of money. And what's the problem is that, unlike the old days, I don't know if Legs Diamond and Dutch Schultz and those guys were alcoholics, but in this drug thing, the distributors are also consumers. You know what I mean? They're addicts. Well, they're peddling this stuff. So this is a real problem. And I think it's...
Yeah, well, alcohol is not necessarily an addiction. Mm-hmm. But drugs, I mean, you can become addicted to drugs. Mm-hmm. And do you think that your house was singled out when they...
this is what's happening in Oakland. I organize a home alert program. And people organize home alert programs all over the city.
Seem to like be a neighborhood watch.
Yeah, they seem to be targeted for reprisals. There's an elderly lady, their house was firebombed. So I read the newspapers about how... you know, people who are involved in trying to stop this stuff are singled out for reprisal. We've been very lucky so far that, you know, that incident, which may or may not have... But my car was broken into three times. That seemed to be a little weird that somebody hit my cars, you know, three times, break-ins. And so, I mean, it's a very difficult... It's a major problem here. And I don't want to sound dramatic, but I think this cocaine stuff threatens the survival of our civilization. This is a major problem. You know, civilization can go down a tube because of a problem like this, you know, like a plague or just it takes something like this to do. This can happen here. And when I discuss this situation in the West Coast, I get from these people who live in $250,000 homes who are not anywhere near the kind of problem that we have. They say, well, these people are not political. How can you call them terrorists? Well, I've been reading Carlos Lader's comments, and he's political. He says he wants to destroy the United States. He says that. He says that the addiction, drug addiction is the Achilles heel of this country, and he sees himself as fighting the imperialists. Yeah, I guess he doesn't understand imperialists drink alcohol. But there seems to be a political element in this stuff, you know.
Yeah, and I was reading in the... that's possible. I was reading in the Times earlier this week about crack.
Yeah.
And this article said that of all of the cocaine derivatives, this is the worst because... it's almost impossible to end the addiction, and it's worse than heroin, according to this article, because it's almost impossible once a person is addicted to crack to get hold of it, even with help. It's almost impossible, and as a result, And the high lasts only for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So some people smoke crack over and over, like 20, 30 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such an addictive drug that nobody knows how to stop it.
Yeah.
Nobody knows how to fight it.
Yeah. Well, where I am, and the way I look at it, from my point of view, is that there doesn't seem to be any success in fighting the supply side nor the demand side. And at this point, my brother's physician and there are politicians in Oakland who agree that maybe the step is to legalize the stuff and, you know, use the money for education, as we do with cigarettes. You know, more people die of cigarette smoking than they die of crack and cocaine, and more people die of alcoholism. So that's the point of desperation that we're at now. And when people say, I've noticed the people who say, well, this will send a wrong message, they don't live around it. I mean, that is a factor. I mean, it's like somebody did a play here in New York in the 60s. I never forget it, called Shaved Elbows, where it said, if you want to get over an Oedipus complex, live with your mother for a couple of weeks and you get over it. I mean, it sounds extreme. But the analogy, I think, it holds true of this thing. I mean, if you live in a neighborhood where it's happening, you become very desperate. You're looking for solutions.
And, it doesn't have to be legalized, though.
Mm-hmm.
It could be distributed, however, mm-hmm. to addicts. And the word methadone is.
It should be regulated.
See, if you legalize mm-hmm. it, it's like encouraging an addiction.
Well, you know, regulation or whatever. It has something has to be done.
In other words,
to take these tremendous profits out of this stuff.
In other words, you wouldn't want to legalize it so that somebody who never had drugs would go and buy it.
Oh, not at all.
So
I would
make it available.
We'd like to see it taken out of the distribution of this stuff taken out of the hands of the underworld.
Yeah.
Okay, because that's the problem that we're having. Because these people have it's an enormous amount of money these people are making, $500,000 a week, some kid 22 years old making that much money, or $1 million, and then you know, the family becomes corrupted because you may be of an impoverished family, and the parents haven't seen this kind of money before, so they look the other way. So it's like wrecking the values of the community, and it becomes parasitical because it drags other people down. You know, I hear the argument, well, from downtown where all these buppies and yuppies live, they say, well, you know, this is like encouraging suicide. That's not the parallel. I think it's more like somebody going in a supermarket wiping out everybody because he wants to commit suicide, but it's against his religion or something like that. You understand what I mean? It's taking a lot of people down. Everybody commits suicide. If you're in a neighborhood where this stuff happens, your neighborhood can be transformed into Skid Row overnight. I've seen that, you know, neighborhoods in Oakland. Just transformed overnight when this element comes in there. And what they do is they move into middle-class neighborhoods where these blacks have, black couples have saved money all their lives to get away from this junk. They move in there because it's perfect camouflage, you know. It's like they have the resources and the money not to live anywhere else, I mean, to afford this. So what's happening now, you know, you have to be very practical. And I think if you look at Western philosophy, it just seems that an individual has to be sacrificed for the general good. I mean, that's all. That's Christianity. You know, that's all the way back. And so instead of having one person take everybody with him, you know, we have to sacrifice that one person. I think we're at that point now.
Yeah, and the violence is what disturbs me. I was reading that night before last in Brooklyn alone,
mm-hmm.
there were 8 murders in one night, all drug-related, including in one apartment, 3 people were murdered. 3
mm-hmm.
women were murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Drug paraphernalia.
I read about that.
But that's only in one borough. I mean,
well,
I don't know how many murders there were that night throughout New York, but I mean, in one area, 8 people?
We have a lot of drive-by shootings all over the country, and Oakland is about next to Miami, in drug-related deaths.
Is
you know, homicide. Yeah, it's next to Miami. I told the police chief Hardy, who's a very pragmatic man. I mean, he said, you know, he just doesn't have the equipment to stop this stuff. He did, because of all the money that's available, right? The police are outgunned. Okay, they just don't have the resources or the power to stop it.
Well, let's talk about some of the other points that you raise in your book. Let's see, most of these essays were printed elsewhere, weren't they?
Well, there are some that are printed here for the first time. For example, the Orwell piece, 1984, and some others. I think that was misleading. I think in one of the early reviews it said that they were all printed elsewhere, but there's some there that are printed in that book for the first time.
Yeah, tell me about your essay on Orwell. I mean, certainly Orwell you know, when you think of the year 1984, and you automatically think of Orwell, and yet you did mention in the essay about his writing style, which his love scenes and things like that, which is somewhat awkward, and yet the book must have had a major impact.
But when I came to New York, I had a job on the East Side there, which gave me the time to read books, and it was one of the first early books that really impressed me. When you go to a university, you get a survey course, and you got to read the book in a week. I really digested that book, and that really influenced my first book, 1984, The Freelance Pallbearers, which was my first book published in 1967. It was in the 60s in this town that I read Orwell. And what I was impressed by was that even though years later I read it again, I found that maybe the writing style has much to be desired. It's prophetic, and it transcends craftsmanship. You know what I mean? I mean, everybody, we have hundreds of craftsmen in this country who are in a university like I am, or as I am, and but they don't have any passion, they don't have any feeling, they don't have any prophetic power, and this guy was really turned on to something. I mean, he had the vision. So this is a very rare book where maybe the art is not all that great, but art has to take a second place to the vision. And
do you teach this book?
I don't use that in my classes. I used to teach lit courses. I do it once in a while again. If I want to read a book line by line, I'll take maybe four or five books. I think some of the feminists accused me of not reading their work, so I took all their books and read it line by line and was influenced by them, But I usually teach writing courses because I'm able to see results. I'm able to see students go out of there and become novelists or become get on the manufacturing end of publishing and desktop, all this stuff. So I'm able to see results. But I don't teach that book, though I think that's one of the key books of this century, 1984. My criticism of the book after looking at it again was that Orwell, from his privileged position, didn't see that 1984 had already happened for some people.
Mm-hmm. Who is Orwell talking about?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to say. I think this guy is probably a political cynic the way I am. And that is sort of a plague on both your houses position. I don't think he saw any redemptive qualities in capitalism nor communism. And now they seem to be getting together. I mean,
Orwell was a man of the left.
Had left-wing politics, but was disillusioned by the left. Yeah. And so ended up probably as a political agnostic.
Interesting description. Right. America, the multinational society. What do you mean by that?
I just came back from Europe, and it's very interesting the way European intellectuals look at this society as opposed to how some of the ideologues and some intellectuals in this country look at it. They see America's civilization. I asked Michelle Fobb last week, who teaches Afro-American literature at the Sorbonne. I mean, it's old school. And he says, I said, why do you see it? Why do you teach this literature, Asian-American literature and all this? Maybe Italian American and all this. Well, why do you teach this literature? And at home, I would have an argument. I read the New York Times. There's an op-ed every day opposing ethnic studies. He said, because Europeans see American civilization as some total of a number of cultures, while some of our intellectuals and people in the universities see it as a monolithic culture. I agree with the idea of America as civilization. You can't get past it. And in that essay, I try to go into details using New York as an example, because this is a multinational town. See, I walk across town from Lexington Avenue to Sixth Avenue. You run through all kinds of cultural differences, cuisine and fashion and even the language. I was coming up in the elevator here, people talking Italian. I used an example of a fair that was held in this town to show how different cultures are blending, and the importance and the richness that one finds in cultural diversity. But this is the argument that's going on currently. If you read the newspapers, that there's one culture and that should be imposed upon everybody. And they always cite people like Shakespeare, And I say if Shakespeare had this attitude, he would never have written plays set in Italy, or he would have never written a play where a black man was the protagonist, Othello. So this is a problem that we're wrestling with, and I think the multicultural idea will probably gain. Stanford adopted a multicultural program, Stanford University, and I think the Secretary of Education was very indignant about that. Secretary of Education had a very confrontational style, and he said, using these non-Western writers, James Baldwin is certainly a Western writer. I mean, you read James Baldwin, and it's all in this Christian metaphor, and he was an evangelist, and he read the Bible. Bible's the most important book in West civilization. You can't top it. I'd never write a book as great as that. I realize that.
Think of the royalties.
Right, absolutely. And Toni Morrison is being taught at Stanford, and Toni Morrison was a classics minor. And if you read Tar Baby, for example, carefully, you'll see that one of the emperors of Rome is used, the name of one of the emperors of Rome, I think it's Valerian, one of them. There's a plant named after him. And she uses this character, this decadent character in the Caribbean, and gives him the emperor's name, and even uses botany. I think this emperor Valerian was a botanist, and this guy's a botanist. I mean, so this Toni Morrison and James Baldwin know their way around Western civilization. So, but for them to say that, this is sort of outside the Western tradition is ignorant. I thought that was tokenism for them to adopt, a few writers. But at my university, at the University of California, Berkeley, even all the sororities and fraternities, we give these kids a hard time right now, they're all, they're not committed and they're not engaged. All they care about is money. But even the sororities and fraternities on my campus, endorsed an American culture's requirement, which meant that, along the line somewhere during your 4 years in the university, you take a course in Asian American or Native American or African American literature, whatever, right? And that was voted down by the faculty. So, and it was amazing to me that the guy who led the fight against ethnic studies or American cultures was from a business school. I'm saying, my God, we got this trade deficit here. One of the reasons we have a trade deficit is because a lot of our people have difficulty with other cultures. They go to Japan and mess up. They don't know the protocol. So we have to learn about other cultures. And it seems strange to me that the man from the business school would lead this fight. I mean, the Fortune 500 ought to put a contract out on this guy. This is a debate that's going on, but I think that there's a hunger for this among American readers. They want this. That's been my experience, and they want to know. And in our organization, we've even led to, we're in touch with the vanguard Italian-American, Irish-American intellectuals, and we find that they have the same problems. We have a tendency to look at everybody as white coming from an ethnic community, right? But, I talk to Italian-American and Irish-American intellectuals. They have difficulty, too, sorting their cultures. When I ask students in my class, if they're Italian American, Irish American, or Greek American, they hide under the table. They want to get away from that. They're ashamed of their immigrant grandfathers, and these grandfathers are probably more literate than they are. Do you understand?
I understand that. I'm not so sure that's always the case in New York. If you see these parades,
it's different in New York.
The Steuben Day Parade and the Greek American Day Parade and the Puerto Rican Day Parade, mm-hmm. the Columbus Day Parade.
It's different in New York.
And, they march up Fifth Avenue by hundreds of thousands of people. You've heard about the WASP parade here in New York.
Where the native costume
is. It marches across Fifth Avenue.
And native costume is a tuxedo?
There are not too many WASPs.
No, you're right about that. New York is very, very, it's like, reminds me of New Orleans because, it's sort of different. You know what I mean? I go to New Orleans, and unlike any place I've been in the United States, so is New York. Thomas Sowell said that when he came to New York, he first encountered ethnicity in the same way with me. I didn't know who people were in Buffalo when I was there. I knew there was a big Polish-American population, but we never had that much contact. When I came here, I became acquainted with ethnicity, and it's probably because I came here that I was able to recognize it on the West Coast. But on the West Coast and other places, the ideal seems to be this sort of bland, amorphous identity that has nothing to do with details.
Well, and that's the image I get of California anyway. But I was reading some time ago, I think it was a book by Frederick Lewis Allen called Only Yesterday. It was a book written quite a few years ago about America, and America growing up in the century. And he writes of the Americans being sent to England during the First World War. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the English were delighted that the Americans were entering the war. Mm-hmm. And they went over on a troop ship, and the English thought the Americans were going to be just like they. But they didn't look like English people. Mm-hmm. They had these strange German names, Polish names, Hungarian names. But the English had this image that Americans were like the English.
Right.
And it was indeed a melting pot, all these people, and they were completely different.
Well, see, when you get on a campus, as I am, or you get away from the community or get away from reality, maybe, that seems to be ideal, to make everybody into an Anglo. And so we'll all be like Alistair Cook on Masterpiece Theater, you know. But that's not going to work. So that's the source of the discussion we're having on campuses nowadays.
Well, let's talk about a couple other things here in the book. You have a very interesting essay on the Weidman brothers, John Edgar Weidman, of course, the writer, and his brother Robert. He's still in prison, isn't he?
I think he is, yeah.
Tell me about the Weidmans and why you thought this was a review of Weidman's book, Brothers and Keepers, that published in 1984. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the Weidmans.
Well, I think it it reflects the split personality you get in a lot of ethnic communities. You know, the old movie about the guy becomes a priest. And his brother's a hoodlum, you know. right. But we get a lot of that out of Hollywood. I think they were talking about Irish Americans when they did the Cagney movies, you know. So I mean, it's a split that we find, you know. Although I find that a lot of media pays attention to the so-called underclass, you know, which is what 1% of the population in New York, right? According to the New York Review of Books, just a small minority. But there's the other side, the angelic side, which Weidman represents. And I was very curious about this tension because I see it happening in not only ethnic communities, but in the country in general. We have this split personality, this angelic side and the other side, which is like, which leads to the scandals on Wall Street down to, you know, the ghetto. You know, you know what I'm saying? And even in the White House, I mean, there's a scandal in the White House now about drug sales or something. How do we reconcile that? And I think Weidman's meditation in that the book he wrote, Brothers and Keepers, he comes to grip with that, but at the same time he feels very guilty, you know, being a liberal. I guess I'm a liberal also, that he can't do enough for his brother, and that he becomes a very self-conscious of his background, his education. And what I say in that book is that we need more guys like him, you know what I mean? We need Weidmans who are able to see both cultures. You know, here's one guy, one kid grows up like, you know, the Sly Stone song, the family song they sing. One kid grows up in the ghetto and he goes into crime. Another kid leaves and has a larger perspective and goes through different communities, goes to educated in England, and becomes guilty about that. Guilty because I guess he didn't stay where he was supposed to be. And what I say in the essay is that he shouldn't be guilty about it, because we need more mediators. We need more people who are able to go between different cultures and reconcile differences.
Was I mispronouncing his name?
Weidman. Yeah, Weidman. Yeah.
The tradition of serious comedy in Afro-American literature. Tell
yeah.
me about that.
Well, you know, I get into trouble. I've always gotten into trouble with critics because my stuff is funny. You know what I mean? Since 1967, since living here, and this is an intellectual town, and learning things and doing more research, I found that there's a tradition for the kind of style I'm in, both Native American literature and Afro American literature. But it's an underground tradition. You know, it's not the literary tradition. You know what I mean? The kind of stuff that the tall tales and the yarns that are part of the oral tradition. Very funny, very comic, very satirical. And so what I did was I wrote this essay for an address I made to the English Institute at Harvard on this tradition that you don't learn about in school, but it's there. And so I consider my books to be carriers of this tradition. I would say this sounds strange, that maybe this goes back to 1,000 years in this country. If you go to Native American literature, you always get the trickster tale, where the trickster tale, or the coyote tale, or the raven, where this is somebody who is very comic, who turns things upside down, who's prone to mischief, but at the same time enlightens people. You understand me? A trickster comes to dinner and eats all the food, eats all the chicken, you know, and maybe belches. But he also brings light to the world and brings knowledge to the world. This is another tradition in American literature, but we just don't know that tradition that well. So, although black critics may say there's no precedent for my writing in black criticism or black literature, and some so-called white critics may say that there's no precedent for my writing in white literature, I would say that there's precedent for my writing in American literature, but they're not acquainted with the tradition.
We probably touched on
tradition of folklore. Now, you look at Walt Disney. I mean, he was genius, right? I mean, lousy politics, but a genius. He took advantage of this stuff. You know, you look at Song of the South, where those animal characters, are entertaining and comic, but there's always a moral in this stuff. You know, there's always a moral. There's always some lesson that is imparted by these tales. But I even understand that, Bugs Bunny was based upon Native American and Afro-American images of the hair, the trickster hair, you know. So, I mean, well, Disney knows this stuff, you know.
And he talks like he's from Brooklyn. The rumor that Walt Disney is on ice, you know. Did you know that?
That's a California rumor, probably.
No.
Oh, yeah?
See, they didn't have a funeral.
For is that
Disney
right?
And the funeral. I was reading a biography of Disney by Leonard Mosley.
Uh-huh.
And he had been very interested in this technique in which the body is frozen and then brought back to life. I can't remember what they call it now.
I can't remember either.
But so there are all sorts of rumors that Walt arranged to have his body frozen upon his death. So you never know. He might come back.
And do some more cartoons.
Be great. Part two.
Yeah, right. Be great.
We kind of touched on this, but he had an essay called America's Colorblind. Tell me about that.
About the, I think I was talking about, I think that was sort of like a...
The modeling of minorities.
Yeah, that was sort of a reply to Pete Hamill.
What did he say?
Well, you know, I think Pete Hamill's become sort of like the welfare king of the black pathology racket. Every time I look around, he's got some open letter to some black person. Today he's got one in the New York Post, open letter to Mike Tyson. Then in the Esquire, he had an open letter to Max Roach. And then he had the same essay in the Village Voice and New York Magazine. So here's a guy that's really, you know, writing, getting paid for the same article. I don't want to, but Pete Hamill came to San Francisco and he was saying, well, you know, why don't blacks be like the Asian Americans? You know, Asian Americans hate to be called that. They're 38 distinct groups. You know, you can't, if you lump a Japanese American with a Chinese American or Korean, you can get into a fight. But anyway, he lumped them all together and said, well, we ought to be like that. So I wrote a tongue-in-cheek piece here about how at one time blacks were the model minority. You know, that when in the 17th century or the early 18th, to the early 18th century, blacks were said to be better workers than the Irish Americans and the Indians, and that there's been a succession of model minorities, and right now we're sort of like the Chicago Cubs of the minorities, where we can't seem to get any hits or home runs, and that maybe one day we'll be the model minority again. That was a tongue-in-cheek thing, but I think that Pete had overlooked the fact that, you know, so-called certain Asian American groups have problems also that might be called pathological. Do you understand me? That we find 40% of the heroin trade in New York, for example, I read the Chinese latest issue of Penthouse, as a matter of fact, talks about the Chinese mafia engaged in taking the drug trade over from the traditional ethnic groups. And there are other problems. I interviewed, actually went out and talked to Asian American intellectuals. These guys who write these articles about the model minority never really talk to Asian American intellectuals. I know a lot of them, and they hate that stuff, you know. They hate that stuff. There's a lot of poverty in New York Chinatown and San Francisco Chinatown. I mean, everybody's not a valedictorian or getting A+, but that seems to be the idea that's promoted, and that's a myth. And it's just as, you know, I conclude the article, and one of the Asian American playwrights, Jenny Lim, agreed that to say that, you know, all so-called Asian Americans are proper, upstanding citizens driving Hondos is just as racist to say that all black people on welfare are selling crack. So, you know, Peter's the kind of guy who goes up to the Hotel Martinique and say, well, look, you know, these guys out there talking like Walt Disney, so a Song of the South and language and everything, and they're messing up and everything. And that's not a true picture of the African-American community. You know, you have to look beyond the facade. You have to look beyond the facade. And living in a ghetto, as I have, I grew up in one. I left for a long time in the suburbs and all that stuff. And then I moved back to the ghetto 10 years ago. It's quite more complicated than that. There are all types. There are people who keep their lawns up and their repairs up and their bums. I mean, it's all variety. And Pete is also saying that the middle class blacks who've made it, right, should return to the ghettos and provide leadership. I agree with that. You know, I looked at all these commencement addresses made by black celebrities talking about poverty and crime and everything. And, you know, that's a good question. Maybe, you know, they would help out a lot if they returned, because after the exodus of middle-class blacks from the ghetto, The vacuum was filled by these hoods and criminals. They took over, see?
Yeah, but people would have to have a social calling, a desire to conduct a social mission, and most people just want to get on with your
lives. Yeah, but I respect that. I respect that. I'm not saying that people should do that, but if they're going to mild this rhetoric and be concerned, pretend to be concerned about you know, poverty and the underclass in order to make white audiences feel guilty at you know, Vassar or wherever they make these commencement speeches, they ought to come down there. We need them down there. But at the same time, Pete Hamill, who said this, lives in the West 70s, and I was in Boston, and there's an Irish American underclass. There are Irish American people in poverty, and there's a tension between Irish American immigrants, Irish Americans, and Irish immigrants. There are tensions between these communities in Boston and all around the Northeast. So if we should go back home, he should go back. Pete should leave Upper West Side and stop lecturing us and go back and help the Irish American people in their ghettos.
That's Pete's job, to lecture everyone.
Is it? Well, but you know, the guy ought to pick on. I mean, you know, Max Roach is not going to. You know, Max Roach is busy, and Mike Tyson's certainly not going to answer him. He's saying Mike Tyson ought to provide an image for. You know, pimps and, you know, we're all pimps. I mean, I know Pete, you know, I have an Irish American ancestry. A lot of us do. And, I kind of tease him in another essay saying, well, maybe, we don't have assets because our Irish American great, great grandfathers, abandoned these women they had children by. But, and I met him at the Celtic Foundation because I'm a member of the Celtic Foundation, you know, and when the speaker said, here's an Irish American poet, Ishmael Reed, half the people dropped their forks and their plates. So we've been collaborating with the Irish on more than tap dancing. But, I think, that all of us should do that. If he feels that blacks ought to go back, middle class, successful, called successful blacks, I would like for them to do the same thing. It's their choice, as you said. Then he should do the same thing for Irish Americans because it's interesting. He's concerned about these underclass people in this city, and I think it's, some of these people are homeless. When I came to New York, there were rooming houses. Now everything's a condominium. The rooming house I lived in is now a condominium. I paid $8 a week. I was able to write and work, you know, night shift at a very low-paying job, and then I was able to do better over the years. Now people don't have that in Boston and the Northeast. They are out in the streets. But some of these people are, yeah, vicious. You can find vicious people in every group. And I wanted to remind Pete that the group that gave New York police all the problems the last 20 years was an Irish-American group called the Westies.
Oh, that's right.
You know, and I read an article about the Westies' activities, and they were really gruesome. So, you know, we all have problems, and these are American problems.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I see your novel, The Terrible Twos, has been reissued in paperback, so that's new. And, of course, you're writing this fighting.
And Reckless Eyeballing. Reckless Eyeballing has been released also.
That's out in paperback?
That's out in paperback, yeah.
That's right. When are we going to have another novel from you?
Well, The Terrible Threes gets worse.
That's kidding me.
No, yeah, Terrible Threes will be published in... the Spring by Athenaeum, who's bringing all my books out. They're bringing all the novels from 1967, the freelance pallbearers, all the way up to the present. And I'm also doing, they're going to publish a science fiction novel of mine later, in 1990. But The Terrible, yeah, new book.
Been out?
No. And The Terrible Threes is new, and that'll be published in spring.
What's
and
that gonna be?
Well, that's about a TV evangelist who becomes chief of staff in the White House, the most powerful man in the government, and who hallucinates.
That's,
you know.
Not far-fetched.
Well, you know, it's amazing. I had a TV evangelist in Terrible Twos, which was published in 1982, and, you know, you say, well, I can't keep up with reality. I should do something else, you know.
Well, Ishmael Reed, it's always good to talk to you. And
well, thank you, Doc, for having me on.
Your books come out, you ought to come back.
I'll come back for the Terrible Threes.
Great, because I don't think we're going to run out of things to talk about.
Great.